And the practice is based on the two components, that there's a human side, the fraternity or the brotherhood, based of individuals that have a magnetism, have an energy, like something like Reiki, that they're able to project. And when these individuals practice together in certain rituals, that energy is collected. And then there's a divine, the Miriam. The Miriam is a Kabbalistic version of the Maria. You know, if we just look back to World War I, with, you know, 20 million people died, and died very brutal, and a lot of, not only the ones that died, but some of the ones who came back were even worse off. You know, half their face blown off and missing limbs, and just the amount of agony. That energy is released in the cosmic, in the Imperium. And that energy doesn't die. Energy gets cycled. So that energy pools itself. There's a certain quality. There's a heaviness. There's a tonality, a texture to that. That pools. And when, just like a cloud, when it pools and it builds up, it disperses. For 15 years after World War I, you know, the mid-30s to the 40s, and then 15 years after World War II, you had the 60s with all the changing, you know, the questioning of authority, protesting the war, all that kind of rebellion that occurred. It's a revulsion of the existing order. What is that source? What is that seed behind that? And Kremert says it's that pooling of suffering of humanity, of energy that's finally being released.
Hello and welcome to the Spirit Box. Season 2, everybody! We're still exploring folklore, magic, the world of spirits, and everything in between. But I'm tremendously excited to be back. And we're going to kick off season 2 today. This is exciting, very exciting. So for those of you who don't know or don't care, I have been away for the last 3 months working on a project on the Dark Man. For those of you on the Patreon, you know all about it. But I'm pulling together what I think is the case for the Dark Man as the father of witches from a folkloric perspective, and marrying that up with the experiences of witches, contemporary and those in the past. So that's what I've been doing over the last 3 months. I've been lucky enough to work with some absolutely tremendous people, most of which have been on the podcast and at some stage, some will be future guests. Anyway, I'm not going to dwell at that point too much. You know, it's not about me, the show. Well, I mean, it is a bit, but mainly it's about the guests. So I'll try and focus on that. So today, for episode 1, we welcome David Pantano to discuss his work on Kemeritz and the Fraternity of Miriam, and the recently published work that he translated from the original Italian, The Hermetic Physician. So Giuliano Kemeritz was born in 1861. He was his original name was Ciro Formisano, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, probably not. And he was one of the most influential Italian occultists, alchemists, and hermetic masters of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Though he remains pretty much unknown to English readers, which is why we're doing this show. In 1896, Kemeritz began writing about natural and divine magic, healing, and alchemy through the journal El Mondo Secreto, The Secret World. He also founded a hermetic school of philosophy, as well as the magic group, which we're going to discuss today, the Magical Fraternity of Miriam. Within the Miriam, he sought to use hermetic, magical, and Pythagorean principles to harness the power of the psyche and convey collective energies for therapeutic purposes and distance healing. His initiatic order would become the principal esoteric society in Italy, and it kind of comparable to its British counterpart, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, but it was forced to carefully be a carefully guarded secret as Mussolini's government rose to power. So in this unique compilation of essays, David Pantano presents an in-depth study of Kemeritz's life and work by his student and initiate Italian esotericist Marco Daffi. Throughout the collection, David Pantano provides excellent annotations and offering the English reader an essential historical and mystical context for Daffy's work. And that really comes across in this conversation as David demonstrates an incredible ability to recollect specific details from this work. So David also discusses with us rare and unpublished texts written by Kemmerich and intended for Miriam's practicing members. And these papers really help paint a picture of the inner workings and magical operations of this fraternity. And these will be in this publication or are available for the first time in English. So I'm delighted to have David here to discuss these this interesting piece of esoteric Italian history with us. Now, in the Plus show, we discuss the Fraternity of Miriam today. What's that group look like in its current state? And further to that, David talks about how the adepts of the order would work with the Aeon, the entities they named as Aeons. And we unpack what those Aeon spirits are. And he goes on to discuss the types of charms, although that's not the right translation in English, of that the order used to engage with the Aeon spirits. Now, if you want to hear the Plus show, you know the drill. Sign up to Patreon and you get not only the extended version of this show, but the extended version of every show since the Patreon has been created and hours of bonus content. Okay, so let's get on with the show. So welcome, Dave Pantano, to the Spirit Box. This is the first show of season two. So you're the icebreaker for the new season. Congratulations.
That's awesome. Thanks. Thanks for the introduction, Dara. And I look forward to this conversation. And cheers out to all the listeners out in Great Britain and throughout the Commonwealth. Mm-hmm. I look forward to this conversation and open to any questions, any areas we want to discuss.
Brilliant. So your work came across, I guess, my inbox in relation to the title you just recently released, The Hermetic Physician. I was really interested when this first arrived in my inbox because I wasn't familiar with the Italian occultist that whose work you were translating. So to kind of introduce the theme to the show, can you give the audience just a little bit of a bit about your background and then kind of an overview of the book?
Sure. My background, I'm an independent researcher. I've written a couple of books. The president one book was called The Magic Door, which is a history of the Italian Hermetic tradition. And this one that just came out, The Hermetic Physician, published by Inner Traditions. I believe it was released last week here in North America, and I believe in the UK and Europe this month, I think in mid-month, I believe. And my background is in studying the spiritual traditions of consciousness, metaphysics, philosophy of both the West and the East. And my area of specialization is in the Hermetic tradition, and specifically that branch that took root in the Italian peninsula in around the Renaissance time, around 1450, with the discovery of the Corpus Hermeticum manuscripts in Byzantium by an Italian monk, and he brought them to Florence under the patronage of Lorenzo de' Medici, and had the leading scholar of the day, Marsilio Ficino, to stop his work of translating the Platonic work to focus on the Hermetic work. So my interest in Hermeticism in that Italian branch really was generated through my interest with the Neoplatonic philosopher of Marsilio Ficino and Giordano Bruno, that whole tangent that came up through the Renaissance. And I guess what really the continuum is, I mean, it stopped probably in around the 1600s. There was a work called Il Mondo Magico delle Eroi, The Magical World of the Heroes by Cesare della Riviera, a count. And so I think the last really hermetic work that followed that pattern from Ficino to Bruno, Campanella, Pico della Miranda. And then I guess with the Cartesian Revolution that occurred in the 1600s, Hermeticism went underground. It was no longer, it wasn't looked well upon by the scholars of the day, even though there were scientists and savants. Newton springs to mind, who continued that. It took on a different trajectory.
So what brought you to Krimmert's then?
So through purchased some books in the late 80s and just blown away. Again, there was this continuum of a tradition of a knowledge that aligned with the works I had read previously from the likes of Giordano Bruno and Marsilio Ficino, but also incorporated some modern or contemporary scientific and sociological, psychological theorems as well. So it was a very fascinating conjecture to the work that I had written, that I had studied on Hermeticism, that in fact it was a continuum. It didn't die out with in the 1600s with the Cartesian Revolution. As I did more research, the Krimmert's wasn't an isolated occultist or initiate, that he belonged to a tradition or a school. And that basically was the elements. The work itself is just outstanding. It still stands the test of time. Krimmert's is a very unique writer. He writes in a very Kabbalistic way, Kabbalistic in the Italian version of Kabbalism or French version, and not in the in the English speaking world speak of Kabbalism. It has very much a Jewish, Hebraic component. Kabbalistic was a branch of wisdom with Jewish roots, but it really spawned in Italy, and there was some currents associated that kind of just differentiated from the more the Laurianic and the Eastern European branch of the Kabbalah. So yeah, it's just a very interesting lineage that's not well known, and it's sui generis in the sense that it's very much rooted in a branch of Hermeticism that sprung through the Italian peninsula, but had roots prior to that to some of the Neoplatonic authors such as Iamblichus and Porphyry, Plotinus. The various Neoplatonics that was established in classical Rome. So it's a very much an interesting branch of Hermeticism that came out, and Krimmert's focused on the healing aspect of it, or the thaumaturgical aspect of it, as a means to hamper the self-aggrandizement or the tendency for individuals to take up the study to inflate their ego. So the focus on hermetic medical outcomes in the sense of healing, relieving of pain, assisting with more conventional types of medicines was the scope of the practice of the school and the chain that Krimmert's established in the late 1800s, called the Therapeutical Magical Fraternity of the Miriam.
In terms of the fraternity of the Miriam, can you take us through kind of what are the kind of the primary tenets?
Sure. The primary tenets is that there's a it starts with the hermetic tenets that there is no physical spiritual split. The two are connected, and you know, as above as it is below, that everything connects to the one. So the principles are that that there's a correspondence between all animated beings in the macrocosm, and as a macrocosm, as an individual, there's through various types of rituals, there are means that a chain or a collective energy, a therapeutic energy that can be channeled to those who are in the need, who have afflicted, whose own energy are deficient. And the Fraternity of Miriam was a hermetic chain that had five grades that started from the novice, and the highest of the pyramid was the master or the therapeutical Miriam, and they had to demonstrate some capacities to heal or to assist in converting individuals who were inflicted with some sort of sickness, to be able to assist with that, to show demonstrations. And the practice is based on the two components, that there's a human side, the fraternity or the brotherhood, based of individuals that have a magnetism, have an energy like something like Reiki that they're able to project. And when these individuals practice together in certain rituals, that energy is collected. And then there's a divine, the Miriam. The Miriam is a Kabbalistic version of the Maria. It's a state of being, of purity, that overrides the normal phenomenal of being of human. So there's a state or a stage, a level of being that one needs to enter based on individual work, that they're able to reach this stage of purity or state of purity that's called the Miriam. And once enough individuals are able to attain that state, there's a collective pooling of that energy, and that's projected outward to the afflicted party at the receiving end.
It's very interesting, and that's kind of that synopsis you've given is really kind of what picked my interest, is that healing element to it. So it reads like it's like a forgotten healing tradition that is.
I mean, Kremert states, and his masters, where he learned the basics. So Kremert had most hermetic schooling in thaumaturgical practices, but also in his younger years, he went to Argentina and received a degree in traditional medical science. So he had both aspects of it. And the school was founded in a time in the part of Italy where he's from Naples, where they just came out of a cholera pandemic. So not too dissimilar from the pandemic that most of the world came out earlier this year. And the cholera pandemic really devastated that area of Italy. And Kremers, with his master, his teacher named Izar, Izar, discussed about developing a hermetic chain where they could practice some of these hermetic arts of healing based on the ancient mystery schools of Asclepius in Greece and in the Hellenic parts of Egypt, where individuals were able to be brought into a different state than what their normal state is, to be able to transmit energies in a more facilitated manner than in awakened in the normal conscious state that people are in. So we took the premises based on those mystery schools of healing, and with the modern and some of the colleges that this school developed out from various academies in Renaissance Italy, where there were various schools, especially of Salerno, that with Bernardo Telesio, that really developed some of these arcane medical components that combine both physical treatments, say using herbs and fasting and other type of more spiritualistic type of healing, such as observances of the various lunar calendars, celestial configurations, and so forth, And of course, the influence of Paracelsus and the work that he did as well was a major component. But there was these academies throughout the Renaissance that had these various chapters that focused on hermetic healing and occult type of healings that were meant to assist traditional methods of therapies. And so there was a continuum as well. And as well, you can't dismiss the influence that the local confraternities, religious confraternities, had in terms of developing various prayer circles that were used to, an example is the sanctuaries of Loreto in southern France, where people would go to, you know, who are afflicted, to go and you know, through prayers and other type of fasting and other type of rituals, undergo healings and sometimes miracles occurred. So there's a wide range of different influences, but it all converged into various schools that continued throughout the peninsula of Italy, not only in the Renaissance and the post-Renaissance period, but also in the post-Cartesian period. They were more underground in the sense they weren't as prominent, say the famous Platonic school that Pacino revived in the 1470s and so on, but they continued, and some of these practices were passed on. There are various manuscripts that are in the archives of these various schools that were consulted. So back in the 1890s, after this cholera outbreak, when Kremers discussed with his, and Kremers would have been a novice, with his master Izar about founding or resurging a hermetic school based on hermetic healing, he received some of these archives, some of these manuscripts to help form the basis of the practice. But it also needs to be highlighted that when Kremers released his journal called The Secret World, or Il Mondo Secreto, in the 1890s, it wasn't received well by some of the more conservative members of the occult fraternity, or the cult establishment in Naples of that time, called the Egyptian School, which was sort of the superior entity above the various Egyptian Rite masonries, the ones, for example, associated with Cagliostro and the Rites of Miriam, Rites of Mizraim and the Rites of Memphis. There was this order called the Egyptian Order, which was a lodge that superseded or was the mother lodge to the various branches of Egyptian Freemasonry. And there was some conflicts with the work that Kremers was doing, because he didn't have authority to be able to release some of these documents and doctrines that were held to be reserved for the internal membership of the Egyptian order. So that gives sort of like the cultural and structural, the systematic mosaic of that led to the founding of the Miriam as a hermetic chain as part of a school, this branch of school of the Egyptian school. They call it, sometimes called the Italic Egyptian school, which was the doctrinal formation of the Miriam, which Kremers took as the basis and then developed based on his own practices and experiments.
Now, you mentioned the term chain being used in the context of healing. What does that mean? What does that entail?
So picture in your mind a group of primarily men who are wearing red robes, and so similar to, say, a Benedictine order, and they conduct daily rituals and they have various other type of practices in terms of relations, in terms of eat what they can eat, combined with various configurations of throughout the year. There are various calendars that are used that are based on a conjunction of an Egyptian, ancient Egyptian and ancient Babylonian calendar to look at what times are favorable for various types of energies or qualities. And so these red-robed monks, called the members of the fraternity, would practice these rituals at certain time in conjunction with each other to be able to harness this reservoir of beneficial energy based on some of the lunar and celestial configurations, to be able to project that to parties that are afflicted or require a deficiency of energy, given the right type of energy that's been diagnosed based on the affliction that the individual party has.
And I know you mentioned kind of an energy like Reiki earlier. Was the kind of the administration of the healing energy done in a similar way, or was it done from a distance?
Yeah, I'm not an expert in Reiki. I do understand that there are a number of symbols that the practitioner, that there are various grades of initiation in Reiki for a Reiki master, and they use various symbols to channel, much like a mandala uses, as you'd be familiar, Dara, I'm sure, where mandala channels energy. So there are various talismans that are used as part of the healing rituals. And there are various karmans or charms or ritual prayers that have been passed down that are used with various types of healing rituals that the master or the therapeutic Miriam member would engage as part of the healing practice based on the diagnosis, the assessment of the affliction. So it's looking not only at the symptoms, but also at some of the karmic components of the individual that's afflicted, to be able to do the right assessment. So there's a very detailed analysis and therapeutics associated with understanding the level of energy and the quality of energies that needed to be projected based on the deficiency of the party. So the in the school of this Taluk school, there it follows a division of man or of the world based on the Aristotelian four elements. So there's a Saturnian, which is the physical, the Hylic. There's the lunar, which is the emotional, the liquid component of individuals. There's the Mercury, or the intelligent part, and then there's the solar part, or the spiritual part. So a master Miriam would do an examination assessment of all those bodies to see where there were deficiencies and before they would exercise the therapeutic practice, do the right assessment to determine the appropriate therapies for the afflicted individual.
Thank you. And in terms of, like you mentioned, the karmans, or is that that's the charms or the specific symbols?
The karmic component is the karmic predisposition that each individual has that could hamper or could be a factor in terms of the affliction the individual has. So if someone has deep trauma, perhaps even from a past life regression, then the therapeutic master would want to understand how to detect that and how to balance that. So some of the work is there are three types of healing. There's a direct, an indirect, and a neutral. So the direct is about engaging this chain to be able to send energy that would essentially, to visualize, pulverize if there's a tumor or something. Okay. That's a more, and that's done in conjunction with more traditional medicines. Then there's a deeper kind that looks at indirect, that looks at reinforcing the energetic energetic bodies of the individual, which is much more longer term. Mm-hmm. So someone suffering from sleeplessness or listlessness, there's a much deeper level of transmission of energy that's required. And then there's an indirect that combines both, or a neutral that combines both the indirect and the direct. So there's direct, there would be therapies that would focus on the immediate symptom, but also long-term look to minimize some of their karmic impediments by providing the right type of energy boost or triggers to help the individual to blossom, to overcome their physical, psychological, spiritual impediments that that may be manifesting as a physical issue or even psychological issue. It really depends. And some are more complex because the ailment is more than one. There are a number of different elements that straddle the various bodies,
right,
that an experienced master hermetic therapy would want to understand and focus on the Saturnian, the external aspect first, and then go deeper into the levels of being of the individual to lead to a more greater fulfilling recovery and so on.
Was that a spirit guided process, or was it one that was kind of intuitive and through discipline and practice they were able to achieve that kind
of thing? Yeah, Kremers was very adamant that the practice, specifically with the therapeutics, was not to be based solely on intuition. There had to be a firm found that the empirical has to work with the hermetic, and that no one medicine can solve everything. There's no panacea that is a cure-all, and there'll be times of failures. There'll be times where they'll be misguided, but that's in empirical science as well. I mean, in terms of, we come with a discovery, how many different failures, experiences have occurred. So he took a very much a rationalist approach. He was from an era where positivism was very strong in terms that you had to prove it. And he says, same with the practice of the Miriam, that don't take anything for the word, whether from him or anybody else. It has to be demonstrated. There has to be a cause and effect. So to answer your question, there are various rituals that require attaining a level of a spiritual level where there may be entities called aeons that are interacted for hermetic purposes, not dissimilar to how the ancient or how medicine was practiced in some of the mystery schools of ancient Greece and ancient Rome. So of Asclepius and even Hermes, there were similar type of entities. So there's a divine component as well as a natural component to the practice.
And when one got more developed in the fraternity, was it in part to develop a relationship with specific spirits, or was there kind of a like within Telemo, where people work with the goal is to work with your higher holy guardian angel?
So I talked about earlier about this Egyptian order, which was this this college of adepts that oversaw the various Egyptian schools. So some of those schools were the Freemasonry branches of the Egyptian rite, and others were there were other vehicles as well, and the Miriam was one of them. And as part of the school, there were two components for members or initiates. One was the Isaac or lunar, which was what the Miriam was, and then there was a solar component called what they called an ammonium focus, where it was Osiridian, so focus on Osiris. And it was about self-realization, about practices, about perpetuating the noumen, the core of being, the subtlest component of the self. So it wasn't so much about spirit guides as about emancipating as the individual in its spiritual core, which may include various practices that had spiritual entities, but it wasn't the goal in itself. It wasn't the thing in itself.
Cool, thank you. There's an interesting concept that I saw in your material about the idea of a fluidic emanation of suffering, like almost on a country level or you know a continent level. Could you describe that?
Sure. That was a passage that really stood out for me. And Marco Daffy, who's the author, he was a disciple of Kremertz. He had a number of conversations with Kremertz, and you know, Kremertz would say this would be after World War I in the late 20s, that these sufferings that these mass sufferings that occurred in the atrocities of the trench warfare, the First World War, that they just don't die out. That the sufferings accumulate. So the visualization is the Miriam worked on collective energy, beneficial energy, but there's also negative energy and suffering, and that energy pulls together, and it may go latent, and it may reappear. In we saw in the 30s with the rise of the Hitlerism and the Second World War, and the amount of suffering in the Second World War led to potentially a correlation to the turbulence that we saw in the 60s, the revolt and so forth. And Daffy refers to this as the Negrito, the black process of revulsion, where you get out of this system, and it's both at an individual and a collective organism. So as the one is the all, the microcosm is connected to the macrocosm. The opposite could be true as well, that with the right consciousness, that enough of that seeding work can be done, that seeding could develop into a spiritual quid, being like an entity, a repository of benign forces that could spawn as a cosmic egg into a new era, where we can live in with a lot of less suffering and tormentations than say my parents' generations did. But without being an utopist, it's just saying that when you work with the energy, you understand that it's not all good, and there's sometimes that some people that they're so far in their karmic disposition that even the right counterpart of positive energy can't change the fate, the destiny that's once the kinetic energy is gone, is in motion, it's very difficult to change its course if it's at a mature level in terms of it needs to complete or realize itself. So it was an interesting concept that really captured mine, is that if you look at some of these huge and it's not only just war, you look at some natural disasters that afflict thousands of people and so forth, but there are consequences to that. It may not be, you know, in the immediate. It could lay low and then resurface in terms of unbalances at a collective level.
That process where we have a kind of a pooling of, I guess, the energetic residue of mass suffering. Does he describe that as like becoming like a conscious thing, or is it just a case that it just is, that it's like walking into a tar pit?
Yeah, it's actually a good question. It's not so much a conscious thing, at least my understanding of Adara. It's understanding. So the you know, the, if we just look back to World War One, with, you know, 20 million people died and died very brutal, and a lot of, not only the ones that died, but some of the ones who came back were even worse off, you know, half their face blown off and missing limbs, and just the amount of agony. That energy is released in the cosmic, in the Imperium, and that energy doesn't die. Energy gets cycled. So that energy pools itself. There's a certain quality. There's a heaviness. There's a tonality, a texture to that. That pools. And when, just like a cloud, when it pools and it builds up, it disperses. It releases. When it does, it doesn't follow a linear process, because it's at a level that's above the, you know, space-time continuum. It's at a much more subtle level of being, of reality. And, you know, where it suffers, where it disperses, you know, is also different as well. So it's something that didn't, in my readings of the works of Kramers and Miriam, really didn't get explored much further. But it's something that intuitively, I think a lot of people can make sense when you look at time and eras from a cyclical perspective. And that you look at, you know, okay, you know, 20 years or 15 years after World War One, you know, the mid-30s to the 40s, and then 15 years after World War II, you had the 60s with all the changing, you know, the questioning of authority, protesting the war, all that kind of rebellion that occurred. It's a revulsion of the existing order. And what was behind that? Is there some sort of target that consciously we're not aware of? You know, even Jung would say it's in our collective, it's in a collective unconscious. But what is that source? What is that seed behind that? And Kramer says it's that pooling of suffering of humanity, of energy that's finally being released. It's an interesting concept.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. It's a very, very deep concept, you know.
Yeah.
And of a scale that's very hard to get your head around.
Yeah, and I think as a hermeticist, it's easier to comprehend, because it does fit into the principles of the tenets of hermeticism, that everything's interconnected, even at the micro and at the macro level. And, you know, to based on that frame, a hermetic framework, when you take a concept like this, you can piece it together and start to extrapolate logical and rational components that correlate some of the phenomena, which is the last it's the completing stage of a spiritual or of an internal source, right? So when you look at it collectively, and the changes in society and the means of change, and you look back at what could be some of the sources behind that. I mean, there really wasn't precedent for the 60s when you look at it. It's still an outlier in terms of era, you know, in the last 40, 50 years. And, you know, it's when you start to think about, when I first read that passage, like you, Dara, I started thinking about it and doing some what if scenarios, and it really provided some pregnant thoughts in terms of, you know, elaborating further on how this concept could actually play out in the three-dimensional world.
It reminds me of there's a kind of a folkloric story in Ireland about in regards to the famine, the great famine in the 1840s, the mid-1840s, where on the spot where someone was said to die, or to have died, rather, if you trod on that space, you would be immediately gripped with the terrible hunger of somebody who was dying with hunger. You would feel their dying hunger pangs. It's called hungry grass, which makes me think of it on a very, very, very small level. But interestingly, if you look at something like the deep travesty of the famine in Ireland, where the population went from 8 million to 4 million in the space of 3 years, through obviously death and then mass migration. And 70 years later, you've got the kind of the War of Independence. So, you know, perhaps it's a kind of
similar. There's a correlation, yes. When there is such convulsions of that nature, it really looks in terms of how it's affected. Society, the people are no longer the same psychologically. There's got to be changes in the psychological makeup of the Irish pre and post, and it could be a vector in terms of development, in terms of providing certain traits and predispositions of that Irish people have today, that as a result of that. So it's looking at some of these causes and understanding some of their occult connections or links and how they play out in various types of manifestations.
So looking at Kermit's broader work, what was the bit for you that really, you know, was surprising that you weren't expecting?
Honestly, Dara, immersion into his work was a surprise from day one. Again, he writes in a very kabbalistic, or what the French would call Rabelais type of style, which is very lots of double entendres and triple entendres. You just can't flip through the pages. You have to reread it because it's written from another era, as I tried to mention earlier. There's an erudition, there's a humanistic knowledge set that is beyond most people's knowledge set today, and based in terms of references and associations to really the Western canon in terms of, you know, Platonism and mythology. Is very written in a mythopoetic manner as well. It's not very dry stuff. It's very rich in the imagery. So it's a really boon. As I mentioned, I was first drawn to Hermeticism through the works of Giordano Bruno and Ficino and some of those Renaissance authors who talked about the art of love and the filters of love, and talk about, you know, if you have a depressive disposition, you're under the influence of Saturn, and you need to complement that by playing Orphic Inns to be able to raise your spirit. And that to me had an intuitive appeal to it. But that type of material died out in the 1600s. After that, you're getting, you know, things that are, you know, maybe the closest one that Kramer said would be like Eliphas Livy of France, who wrote similar type of treatises. But it really was very difficult to find something of that level that had a strong philosophical foundation, but yet wrote in a very contemporary manner in terms of the terms that were used. They weren't talking about 400 years. It was about the here and now. But the principles the theorems, the even a lot of the references were from mythopoetic form, from various sages that that he was able to quote. So to read that material, when you know most of the material you're reading is just totally from a different part of the universe, was what really struck me first. And then the amount. So Kremers wrote about natural and divine magic. He wrote about alchemy. He wrote about the tarot. He wrote about various forms of divination, hermetic healing. He had both practical and exercises and so forth. So it was a very broad, scope of and range of writing material topics. And again, always in this kind of mythopoetic language that he used, which again is very very difficult. It's not difficult, it's rare and in the 20th century to come across an author like that, but yet still make it relevant to our contemporary world or mindset that we live in.
One area I found interesting was the relationship between kind of the ideas of Christian Science and the fraternity.
Christian Science would have been, it was around the 1870s, 1880s. So it was a predecessor, I suppose, to Kremert the Merriam. And Daffy writes that Kremert was aware of it and aware of their failures, but also their success there. It was a big phenomena in the 1800s, so was Spiritism, seances and so on and so forth. And so, but Christian Science had their own newspaper. They had even political clout. And Kremert's envisioned that the Merriam, these hermetic changes would sprout all over Italy, and eventually open up hermetic clinics, much like you have like Reiki centers and so forth, to help individuals, especially those where conventional science has given up, or those who have been misdiagnosed, or those who felt that the conventional models of therapy weren't working for them. So, and Kremers had apparently a demonstrated casebook of healings or of patients who had improved in their conditions, and he never accepted money. He did it for pro bono, but inevitably those who would heal would donate to him, which he would give to the organization, that type of thing. So the Merriam itself that he envisioned was a group of centers throughout Italy and throughout Europe that would help conventional medicine to provide therapies that conventional medicine didn't touch upon. And he was very strict about it. One thing he took issue with the Christian Science was that Christian Science, throw your medicines and your pills in the fire. Our power is greater. And Kremert's, he denounced that, is that, the work of the Merriam is to work in conjunction with conventional therapies to quicken the healing and to assist the healing process from a different angle than conventional. So he was adamant about not, going, it's our way or the highway or our way alone, is that it need to, that hermetic healing or medicine needed to be converged in with conventional medicine. There need to be a confluence, not a conflict with conventional medicine.
Interesting. There's a few areas that I'd like to pull the thread on a little bit. So just in terms of the Merriam, what does that word represent? What is signified by that word?
So the Merriam is a Kabbalistic form of Maria, So Maria being Mary, you know, the, and so there's a very much a matriarchal and matronal component to it. There's the level of purity. So in Catholicism and Christian theological understanding, that the Maria was the redeeming of Eve, of the fall of Eve. So the represented in Hermetic terms as a state of purity. So reaching a level of purity, of pristine, at a noumenal level. So a level that's not contaminated with the phenomenal world, that has a the laws at the phenomenal level are heavier, the gravity, so on and so forth. So to be able to tap into these beneficial forces, one needed to find their own Miriam. So the Miriam represented the collective organization, that state of purity, and that level of being that emancipated the human animal component.
Well, David, thank you so much for taking us on this journey today. As I said, I really appreciate your ability to recall in such detail the story and history. It's been a really interesting talking to you. If anybody wants to find out more about the book and your work, how are the best place to do so?
The best way is to write to the publisher, Inner Tradition. They have a website. I'm on Facebook and Instagram as well, David Pantano. Not difficult to find. Send me a note. Send it by messenger. Serious inquiries and so on and so forth. And I'd be glad to provide any answers or steer any individual in the right direction. I'll leave it like that.
Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure having you on the Spirit Box.
Thanks, Dara. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Great stuff. I hope you all enjoyed that. Really interesting start to the season. I'm really, really happy to be back. I got some great guests lined up for you. Some of them you'll already know from Patreon. I've been talking about them. But there's some really interesting shows heading your way in the coming weeks as we roll into Christmas. Anyway, thanks for listening. I'm Dara Mason, and you've been listening to The Spirit Box. Take care and talk soon.